Walking past, he sings to me a song. These are holy and wonderful. These are victory and victory. Dear life. The brother's wine. What's gonna happen if I give the man a quarter?
Hello, you are listening to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. That song was Hole in the Bucket by Spearhead off their album Home. This is Hole in the Bucket, KBOO's show on poverty, housing, and homelessness. Hole in the Bucket is on 6 to 7 p.m., the second and fifth Wednesday of every month. This month will be on again Wednesday, the 31st. My name is Jamie Manuel, and I'll be your host this evening. Our mission on Hole in the Bucket is to incorporate the voices and ideas of people who have experienced poverty and homelessness and their allies into our show, making them authentic, informative, and entertaining. On tonight's show, we will be talking to Charles Santos from Roots and Angel Williamson from White Allies Against Racism, a project of Roots. We'll be talking about gentrification and displacement in Portland's communities of color. We will also have a commentary from Jay Thiemeyer later in the show, and we will be playing an interview with makers of a new film on homelessness called Bums in Paradise. But first, we have Liam Delta with the news. Actually, we'll have Liam Delta with the news in just a moment.
The Portland City Council voted 4-1 late last month to designate Dignity Village as a transitional campground. The vote implements an Oregon state law that allows cities to designate up to two transitional campgrounds. The new status will make it easier for the village to come in line with Portland's building codes and clears the way for negotiations on a long-term lease for the city-owned property the village is currently located on. The resolution was jointly sponsored by Commissioners Eric Stinn and Randy Leonard. Nearly all the citizens attending the hearing came out to support the resolution. The most contentious issue for this council is whether the city should subsidize costs to the village. While Mayor Katz and Commissioner Dan Saltzman voted in favor of the resolution, Saltzman expressed concern that any subsidy to Dignity Village in the form of water and sewage costs could ultimately take money away from subsidized housing or other social programs. Both Stan and Leonard downplayed any subsidy received by the village, which Stan pointed out was less than the mortgage deduction he received on his income taxes last year. Commissioner Francis Sconey, who voted against a resolution supporting the village in 2001, again voted against this new resolution. In his view, the homeless are better served by existing social services, including shelters and subsidized housing. Village members and supporters have long argued that this position ignores capacity problems in the current social service system. One woman at the hearing compared the position to telling people without bread that they should eat cake. Hearings for a long-term lease of the village's current site are planned for later this spring. A federal judge ruled late last month that Portland's park exclusion law is unconstitutional. The opinion was issued in response to a lawsuit brought against the city by two women who were excluded from Pioneer Square for hanging a sign on a statue while collecting signatures for a petition. In the court's ruling, Judge Ansar Haggerty said that the law violates the First Amendment and is not necessary to protect the safety of the parks. While the decision rests on the law's violation of political freedom, people experiencing homelessness and their allies have long felt that authorities have used exclusion laws to unfairly target the homeless. The law, as it currently exists, allows police officers and authorized security guards to issue park exclusions for up to 90 days to anyone violating a law or park rule. Exclusions go into effect automatically unless challenged by recipients. As such, recipients are routinely excluded without a hearing to determine whether or not they actually violated a law. Over 2,000 park exclusions were issued by the police in 2002. City Commissioner Jim Francesconi defended the law. Due to lack of jail space, he said park exclusions are needed to enforce the law in city parks. Revisions to the park exclusion law were scheduled for last Wednesday's city council meeting, but were subsequently pulled from the agenda. Mayor Vera Katz said the city is still considering whether to appeal the federal court's decision.
Hello, you're listening to Hole in the Bucket. My name is Jamie, and I am here with Charles Santos from Roots and Angel Williamson from White Allies Against Racism, Project of Roots. And we'd like to start out, we're going to be talking about gentrification and displacement. And Charles, why don't you go ahead and start off by telling us a little bit about Roots and how it got started and what you're doing.
All right, Jamie, thank you. Roots basically got started back in June of 2002. Focusing on social justice and racial justice here in the state of the city of Portland. And right now we're working on, like I said, the gentrification and forced displacement here, and you know, my observations about you know, the neighborhood changing and, you know, being removed, and you know, the new like storefronts coming up, and you know, how people can't afford to stay there. You know, like myself, you know, I was, you know, displaced out of my own house. You know, they want to raise the rents and remodel and then, you know, make it not affordable for me to live there. You know, so me and other people have to move out.
And so new people are moving in the neighborhood, rents are going
up.
Yeah,
rents are going up, and, you know, the townhouse-style apartments where the business on the bottom and the residence on the top, and, you know, they're, what do they call that, exclusive? You know, as far as, you know, the rent, you know, $750 or $850 for a one-bedroom or a studio, you know, when you're making minimum wage is not, you know, very good for somebody like myself. Or anybody else who's poor.
Right. So tell me a little bit about your story and how you got involved with Roots.
Well, I met the director, Lakita Logan, about April of last year, and she was talking to me about a little organization she had called Roots. You know, at the time I thought it was a little and didn't know, you know, the aspects of it. And she was saying that it would be good for, you know, a brother like myself to get involved. And at the time I had just, you know, been awakened politically and, you know, was angry enough to, you know, want to do something with it. You know, just being angry and doing nothing doesn't help anybody. You know, so I was, okay, let's check it out and see what Roots is all about. And came to a meeting, and, you know, we discussed, you know, the issues that I just mentioned about the gentrification and forced displacement. And I said, this is, you know, might be something I can get involved with. And I just kept coming back, and, you know, we'd had, you know, our unveiling in July, which was their year anniversary, and we'd had, you know, some speakers and music, and and we talked about, you know, what it means to be displaced and what it means to be gentrified. And, you know, breaking the word down, you know, gentry, which is the landed people. You know, people moving in from the neighborhood, you know, in from outside of the neighborhood, rather. You know, their money comes in, their people comes in, their building contractors come in, you know, build it all up, make it nice, and then make it expensive. So the people who already lived in the neighborhood, you know, can't afford to stay.
So it's sort of classic colonialism. People move in, the natives have to move out.
Yeah. You know, they can either stay and pay the exorbitant rents, or they can move and pay exorbitant rent elsewhere. You know, because the displacement's been going on since, you know, this is new to me, since, you know, Northwest Portland is where the original neighborhood was for, you know, people of color. And then, you know.
When was that?
Hmm?
And when was that, talking about the history of this?
This was just prior to World War II, I believe, back in the, mm-hmm. the late 30s, early 40s. And then they were moved to, during that period, to the floodplain of Vanport. And, you know, after that flooded, they were moved into the Albina district, the Boise Elliott district on, you know, Mississippi and Albina.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, they were only allowed to get houses and apartments in that area. You know, what they call redlining. You know, you're only allowed to get places in that area.
Yeah, and this was around what time period are we talking?
Like I said, the late 40s.
So this is when there were still laws that prohibited people from selling homes to
lending,
Americans.
Which is, yeah, we'll lend you the money, but we want interest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the redlining is where you can only move here. So if we're going to give you the little bit of money we're going to give you, you can only use it to buy a house or to rent a house in this area only. You know, stay in here.
So these neighborhoods were created through deliberate policy, and now economic trends are disrupting those neighborhoods and displacing those residents once more.
Indeed. Like I was mentioning earlier, I left to move to Seattle,
mm-hmm.
and the section over on 15th and Fremont, it was all boarded up. You know, there was like moss even on the street. You know, and then I moved back and I see it's a Wild Oats, it's a video store, it's a bank, it's, you know, and I'm wondering myself, you know, where did that money come from? You know, it wasn't, you know, community organizing to put that together. It was outside funds, like through, you know, the Portland Development Commission and the other storefront improvement, you know.
So this is policy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, to just, you know, move everybody in and move so-called those people out.
Right. And they don't say out to where, do they?
No, just out. You know, once they're not here, that's, you know, not their problem anymore. You know, which I found distressing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like I said, to be willing to get involved and to actually do something was, you know, a major step for me.
Well, talk a little bit about what Roots is doing right now, and the housing housing subsidy grant.
Oh, we got Roots actually received $7,000 to do surveying and door knocking and outreach. You know, to find the best, you know, the candidates that most were deserving or most in need of the emergency rental assistance through the, you know, the Obama Ministerial Alliance, AMA, which gave, you know, emergency rental assistance to, you know, myself and others like myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Roots was a conduit prioritized for low-income people of color so they wouldn't have to go through the so-called normal channels where they were being excluded or ignored, you know, in favor of, you know, white families who were in need.
And tell me a little bit about your story, because you said you received the housing subsidy.
Yeah, I did. I received, you know, our household that I was living in,
mm-hmm.
and the house we were displaced from, we received, you know, a month's rent, you know, through AMA, so we didn't have to be right away displaced.
Right, so it only delayed your displacement.
Mm, yes.
In this case.
And in the end, we were still having to move anyway, because, mm-hmm. like I said, he wanted to remodel the home and rent it to, you know, a family.
So this isn't... this isn't just part of rents going up because he's paying more on his taxes and passing it on to you. This is, in this case, the landlord saying, I really want to make some more money off
of
this property.
And then we want to make our more money, and, you know, this is how he's going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he can raise the rent and then rent to somebody who can afford that more money. You know, and mostly it's going to be, you know, non-people of color, white people.
White people, families,
as opposed to,
class.
You know, low-income people of color who already have a hard time finding somewhere to rent and not being the first to be looked at for spaces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're moving way out to, like, Southeast or out to Beaverton or, you know, even over to Vancouver. You know, just put out of our own homes. And we're not moving our jobs, so then we have to think about paying for commutes, you know, child care. You know, like, perhaps I lived in the villa,
mm-hmm.
which is being torn down now, and my job was right across the street or, you know, a couple miles away. Now, if I live out on 162nd, you know, I have to worry about my commute to and from there. You know, I might not be able to even hold that job. So it's not just the residents that's being affected. It's your whole livelihood.
You were referring to Columbia Villa, which is being redeveloped right now.
That's right.
And that was traditionally low-income housing.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
it's being redeveloped with mixed housing?
Right? It's going to be private housing, general housing, and then low-income housing.
Right. But fewer low-income housing than what was there before. Tell us a little bit about what other program, what you're doing right now, the events that you're having, and how people can get involved.
Let's see. One of the main events we have right now is called Unity Cinemas, and where, you know, each month we find a movie or watch a movie that, you know, pertains to social justice. You know, our first movie was Amandla, which was about the music that inspired the revolution to abolish apartheid in South Africa. And You know, we sit and just, we watch the movie, of course, you know, and all the events and functions for Roots are for people of color only, so that we can have a, you know, a safe, you know, space for us as people of color to organize ourselves and to educate ourselves and support ourselves, so that we can go out and talk to other people in the community, you know, as a, you know, united people. And like I said, Unity Cinemas will, you know, like I said, watch the movie and discuss what it means to us, you know, what do we get out of it, what do you, how do you think we can implement any ideas that were pertinent to our cause, you know, our organization, you know, how can we put those in effect.
Can you talk a little bit, you mentioned that these events were for people of color only, and you have this project of Roots, White Allies Against Racism, that Angela is here with, sorry. And can you explain to people why that segregation is in place? Because I think some people will hear that and they won't understand and they won't realize why you do that. But I think when people hear about it, it makes a lot of sense.
Segregation, that's a very loaded word there.
I didn't mean to use that word, but I understand what you're doing. I just think if you explain it to people, it makes more sense.
Well, traditionally, when you have organizations that were all about multiculture and, you know, all people, we had issues that were focusing on, of course, people of color. And then at the top of the echelon, you'd have, like, the board of directors or so-called leadership committees would be all white people. And to have white people on top of an organization that's supposed to be dealing with other people of color, you know, wasn't in the best interest of those people of color, because they, like I said, they weren't people of color. They were white folks who were, like I said, making decisions for, you know, us, like myself, people of color. And we felt that in order to have our best interests looked after, we need to have people of color making those decisions for us. The people of color, you know, on leadership positions, on board of director positions. And if, you know, white folks want to get involved, you know, we have the Project of Roots, which is the White Allies Against Racism, which they can get involved to have support for our organization that we do and get out and talk to other white people about the support that they could give for Roots.
I think that's really interesting because so many organizations become like the systems they set out to change, and so you've built it into your structure to avoid that.
Yeah, all decisions come from the grassroots base, the low-income people of color, because that's who we're, that's who our voice is for, and you know, that's who we're speaking for. You know, the board of directors does, like I was explaining earlier, you know, the true democracy where the people are the true voice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the leaders are the conduits for those people. You know, they do what the people request and what the people demand and what the people say. You know, not the other way around where it becomes, you know, since I'm on the board and all our people that I know are all white folks on the board, we're going to do what we decide. You know, and then so goes ignoring the issues of the people of color in that organization. And we structured ours this way to be sure that the voices of people of color and low-income people of color are always heard, you know, always have a say in what goes on and how we progress in our strive to have racial and social justice here in the city of Portland.
And so how can people get involved with Roots?
Well, with Roots, you can get involved by checking out the website at www.rootspdx.org or give a call at 503-288-4021. And that's available Monday through Friday.
And say that number one more time,
that's
folks.
That's 503-288-4021.
Always important to do.
And I'm the secretary there, so you most likely get a hold of me, Charles Santos, and we could maybe set up a personal meeting, or, like I said, you could, you know, email me personally at csantos, that's S-A-N-T-O-S, underscore, san, S-A-N, at yahoo.com, and, you know, set a personal meeting, or if you'd like to come by the office, you know, look online again, and the address is 1104 North Failing Street, that's Portland, Oregon, and, you know, come on through and we'll, you know, have a talk and get you involved and become a Roots member.
And if you're white and you want to get involved, you should contact Angel Williamson at White Allies Against Racism, Project Roots.
Well, the best way to get a hold of me is through my email, which is angelroots@yahoo.com, angelroots@yahoo.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you both so much for coming here and being with us today. And best of luck, and hope to have you on the show again soon.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
del barrio, tumba sin flores, un pobre diablo con dientes de oro.
To Hole in the Bucket. Next up, we're going to go to Jay Thiemeyer with a commentary on A Place to Sleep.
A Place to Sleep. Thinking about what it means. What comes to mind first? Safety, without a doubt. Without even thinking, I'd say that. When I'm worn out, I feel unsafe and vulnerable. There have been times when I desperately wanted just to sit down, but I didn't want to lose my place in line. Had to keep up with the slow shuffling progress. Couldn't lie down. If I had, I'd have passed out, dead asleep. They'd have just stepped over me. Or if they thought, or someone thought they could get away with it, that I had passed out drunk, they'd rifle my pockets or steal. Some would steal just to steal, because they'd been thieved the same way. Or at the very least, if not thieved, I'd be left uncovered on the pavement, rain or no rain. Just something else on the sidewalk to walk around or step over. Nothing really out of the ordinary, just another nuisance. A place to sleep. To have the choice of sleeping when desired requires a place in the sense of a physical location under one's control, habitable, safe, free in the sense of secure, free from God, free from. I can think of a lot of things I used to wish I was free from, the cold, for instance. There's a lot of things those two words bring to mind in themselves, cold and loneliness. Cold leads to wet, freezing, all kinds of doors start opening up. And lonely. There are a lot of places I can remember just hearing the words cold and lonely. A place to sleep. Under control. You can sleep when you want to and when you need to. Not just pound pavement to keep from falling asleep, just killing time, wasting more time, time heavy, pointless, time always in between. Hearing your feet step after step on the pavement, feeling your spine and skull. I've discovered I was asleep while I was walking. For me, it was a very short instant, but I know guys who've said they've covered some ground asleep. They jolt awake and look around and see how far they'd walked asleep and just laugh about it. It was something amazing to find out it had happened to you, after all. That's the way one fella explained it to me, just another miracle in the day. Or stood in the same place like a post while dead to the world, snoring and standing straight as a post. I believe him, just that small experience I had a few times, catching myself and discovering I'd fallen asleep while I was walking but kept walking. It was something to laugh about, break up the routine, take your mind off the fact of having no place of your own to sleep. What a wonder it seemed at times to have once had a good place and now have none but at best a line to stand in, waiting for a bunk or a winter mat or a blanket on the local Salvation Army chapel floor, or one of those rescue missions like the one in Richmond, Virginia. You can find them anywhere. Part of the network, part of the scheme of things. I remember Richmond, where that huge fight broke out because this guy, he'd been wearing his socks for so long, and the people, the staff there, made everybody take the shoes off because they didn't want a fight to break out and have all those street characters armed with shoes on their feet. Good reasoning. Made perfect sense. The staff was safe, and they stayed the hell away when the fight broke out. Good reasoning. No showers and one toilet for 95 men, just like here in Portland at Harbor Lights. And the amazing thing was that somebody actually had the energy to fight to begin with. Where do you get that kind of energy? What saves most of the missions I've been in from a complete meltdown is that everybody's too damn tired, too burnt out from walking and standing in lines all day to put up much of a fuss. Putting up a fuss is a luxury for the young, and usually a younger fella could find some couch or a bed to sleep on. It's only fellas who are getting older, less appealing, smellier, riper, that are relegated to the chapel floors and the missions for a place to sleep. If they're young, it's especially sad, but like the jails, the missions are seen more and more young. It's a sad thing, to be sure. I've seen it myself in just a handful of years. Things have gotten worse. You'd think by now people would be more compassionate, that by now folks would take pity, but it's been the opposite. The dismissal is stronger. You hear it said all the time, they must have done something to deserve this. Folks convince themselves it can never, never happen to them or the people they associate with, nor their children. And the closer the reality that it might easily happen, that it is, in fact, happening to someone they know, or worse, to someone they love, the harder they fuss to separate themselves, to deny and retreat from what's staring straight at them, right into their faces, inescapable. That man they look at is them, just dying for a place to sleep, safe, habitable, permanent for a change. Something fixed in their universe, something they can comprehend for a change. Not that being anonymous in a line of men standing in the rain waiting for a mat on a crowded floor in a charity chapel, being left alone for a moment, is as safe as it will get. Pull the rag hat down over your head and ears and the world can't see you. You're safe. Soon you'll be free to sleep.
Thank you, Jay Thiemeyer. Next up, you're listening to Hole in the Bucket on KBOO. Next up, we have an interview with makers of a new documentary film, Bum's Paradise. Bum's Paradise is about residents of a landfill in Albany, California, and will be showing locally in Portland later this month. In the interview, Peter Crimmins of KALX Radio in Berkeley talks to Thomas McAbee and one of the landfill residents, Robert Berenger. Here it is. To many people, the Albany landfill on San Francisco Bay, just north of Berkeley, is not really a landfill at all, but a spit of land with hiking trails weaving amid an overgrown mishmash of native and exotic plants. If they looked a little closer, they would discover webs of twisted metal rebar and huge slabs of concrete that were dumped there from the time that this was an active landfill. If they looked a little closer than that, they would discover paintings on those concrete slabs, writings on the rocks, sculpture. There's art in that thar landfill. Most of the artwork was created by the landfill's own denizens, a loose community of homeless people who had taken up residence there. Although, homeless is a bit of a misnomer, as the people do indeed have homes, they just don't have addresses. The foragers and off-the-grid citizens have built themselves shanties and plywood shacks, and even a stone castle created by one somewhat delusional resident. They've been living out there for years until 2001, when the city of Albany swept them all out, and now those homeless people are also houseless.
Nearly all of the folks here are unemployed and have free time. This fact gives rise to countless creative endeavors. I have seen many sculptures, paintings, poems, and home improvements, which stand as testaments to the potential in each of us when given the time and space to create freely.
That's Robert Rabbit Barringer, who acts as narrator and guide in the new documentary film Bum's Paradise by Thomas McCabe and Andre Rosen. If I might lift a line from Leonard Cohen, Rabbit shows you where to look among the garbage and the flowers. The first thing I noticed about Robert Barringer when I saw him in the film is that he's surprisingly clean. He wears a white shirt, and it's actually white, a significant distinction from the homeless people usually seen on the streets of Berkeley. The residents of the landfill come across in the film as a different tribe of homeless. They're self-sustaining, and they're settled in their makeshift homes. It took only a few steps for filmmaker Thomas McCabe to discover this bum's paradise.
I lived not too far from the landfill, and I used to see a lot of people with bottles and cans and recycling near that area. I was hanging out at home one day and was looking for work because I work freelance and things were getting kind of slim. And I was like, geez, I got to get a job or I'm going to end up homeless like those people in the landfill. And I was like, wait a minute, they're getting kicked out. I mean, that's how ridiculous is that? So I went out one day and I hiked around the landfill. I spent like a good hour and a half just blown away by all this artwork that I saw out there, assemblages made out of garbage and murals painted on broken pieces of concrete and all these paths that would lead to these little dwellings. And I saw somebody out there who looked like they might live there. And I asked him if he did. And he's like, yeah, come to my camp. And that was Robert Rabbit Barringer.
And they thought they would make about a 15-minute film or something really quick. And it turned into quite a project, 3.5 years in the making. Now, I've been living in Berkeley for about 35 years, and I went to school here, and I've worked in this town. Things just kind of came undone for me, as they have for a lot of people in these times. And so I became homeless all of a sudden, and came to go camping in this landfill, which I knew there were people there at the time, and I figured after a month or so I'd be able to get back on my feet. And I just, I became integrated into this lifestyle and with these people, and it became more and more preferable. I stayed for 2 years until they put us all out. But I thought it would be an excellent subject for a documentary. These were really interesting people. They're not like any of the street people that you see every day. They were some of the older, you know, rail bums and stuff. They conduct themselves by old hobo codes and stuff.
We started shooting. It was only 2 weeks before they were supposed to be evicted. Andre and I thought we'd shoot for a couple weeks before and a couple weeks after, maybe spend a month or two editing, and we'd have a nice little 10 or 15-minute piece about eviction.
Andre is your co-director.
Yeah, Andre Rosen. And the eviction process dragged out for months and months and months. I started running out of money and time, and you know, I got some freelance work, and I would go out to the landfill at 5 in the morning, hoping to catch the cops coming in and ticketing people, because that's when they'd do it, early in the morning or late at night. Then I'd go to work all day, come back from the city, and hang out in the landfill until about midnight. And it was getting very arduous. And when we started out, there were people that didn't want to talk to us, be seen by us, be caught on camera, and Rabbit invited us. Rabbit was the key to this whole thing. He was our guide. So I went and bought Rabbit a camera at a local store.
I didn't know you got the cameras.
They had a 30-day return policy, and after Rabbit was done, I returned it to the store.
Yes.
But after giving Rabbit the camera, everything kind of busted open. People that were shying away from us were opening up, and I had one guy in particular, Walter, come up to me. He's like, "I'm really sorry for the way that I treated you. You know, we just didn't know where you were coming from or where you were going with this film, and it's really cool that you gave Rabbit a camera, and we like what you're doing," and that really helped.
There were people in the circle who felt that it was a very bad thing to do. They always had a policy of never talking to the press. They've trusted the press before and have been exploited with terrible articles. There's a large sense in our community that it's better that the world doesn't know what it's like for us, that that we're really having a pretty good time out there. And if they knew how we were living, they probably would hate us even more, you know, and it would make it harder. When people ask, well, how can we help, you know, it's like, well, if you just leave us alone, like, we really don't want any help, you know. We just want to disappear, you know. It's so hard to just vanish. You know?
I'm wondering if that idea, that just leave us alone, flies in the face of some people who are scrambling to get social services to people who are living on the street.
Of course, yes, and they are really helping a lot of people, and you know, and the drug and alcohol treatment programs are saving lives and so forth. But these programs are not for everybody. And some people choose to live a rough and tumble, adventurous life, and they consider themselves pioneers or whatever, expatriates. You know, they're not harming anyone. They, you know, they just want to live, you know, the way they do. And everybody stay out of the way. But it's not for everybody.
So, Thomas, you left the equipment in the hands of Robert in a place where sensitive recording equipment really sometimes shouldn't go.
I really couldn't believe that one myself, yeah.
At that point, I already trusted Rabbit. It was interesting because I gave him the cameras and some tapes, and I met him about 3 days later, and I had some fresh batteries and some fresh tapes, and he was all jumpy and jittery, and I was just like, wow, what's going on, man? Are you okay? And he's like, oh, I've been so nervous about this camera. You know, I haven't had any drugs or any alcohol in 3 days. And I was like, oh, man, don't worry about that. Just, you know, live your life. Just, you know, don't worry about the camera. You know, try to get me the tapes. But, you know, if you lose the camera, so be it. And, you know, I looked at his footage that he shot, and it was like 25 minutes of this duck.
That was it?
Well,
yeah.
It was a really strange duck. I was just getting used to the equipment, I tell you.
Yeah. You know, once I told him that, he loosened up, and then he was getting amazing stuff. He was like Michael Moore out there chasing the cops around, you know, getting right in their face, you know, asking the tough questions. And it's great, you know, it's just great stuff.
Months, they wanted the camera back, and I'm like, no, I'm just getting it right, you know. And there was so much more I could have gotten. I have no crusade except to follow my bliss, which does not involve confronting the powers that be. I must, however, continue to find the ways and means to maintain my humble yet noble desire to sleep outdoors and away from buildings. It is ironic that I prefer to stay close to the countless options and opportunities which only a vast urban setting can provide while I seek my home and solace in places without buildings, roads, or commerce. I only ask, why can't I stay in a tent instead of a building? That might sound strange to you, but it is my sincerest desire that I can live near buildings but not in them.
Rabbit had journals that were just amazing. You know, I recorded him reading some of his journals, and I was like, there's the film. You know, he's telling the story right there. So we decided that he was going to narrate. When we were putting the film together, there were holes here and there, which if we would have done it like standard films where you have a narrator, we could have written all that, and that would have been easy. But since we wanted Rabbit to tell this story, I had to go find him, tell him what I was doing, tell him where the holes were, and ask him to write something in his journal about it for us, which he would do, and then I'd meet him a few days later, record him on a mini-disc recorder, bring it back to the studio, and try to cut it into the film. And we just kept exchanging that way for over a year, because it took a long time to find him. Since he got kicked out of the landfill, his camps were constantly changing.
I don't know if this film was made on a schedule and he had deadlines, but trying to track down a person who doesn't have a phone, or even an address.
And who's hungry? As soon as you find him, you got to feed him.
How did that work out?
It was torturous. It was a heck of a lot of work, a lot of running around, just time consuming, enormously time consuming. But I knew it would be worth it. Fortunately, I've been working as in commercial editorial for years, and unfortunately, the economy took a digger, and I wasn't getting much work. I was working freelance, and
this is like
2001. So unfortunately, I wasn't working much. Fortunately, I had the time.
It brings up something that I feel sometimes, and maybe people in the Bay Area, more so than other places, you're always concerned that maybe I'm, you know, a couple inches away from being homeless myself.
I actually was working during the film. You know, during the filming, I still had a job.
Mm-hmm. If I can ask, how did you wind up out there? I mean, you said you went through a sticky patch. What was going on?
Well, it's... I don't know, it's kind of political, it's sort of personal, you know, like everybody's story, that the people that you work for, they're exploiting you, and things come undone, and then you go to the next employee, and after 3 years, they want to get rid of you because you're infecting the new workers, they think, because you're cynical, and you just go from one job to another year after year, never get an increase in salary, the rent and everything else keeps increasing.
When you are working, what do you do?
Well, I did picture framing in the Bay Area for 13 years. I was a specialist, a troubleshooter, and I could do some of the most difficult work, but the salary was very low. And that sort of bottomed out. I became over-experienced, and with the big East Bay fire, people stopped investing in art and framed pictures. That became the bottom dropped out of that market, really. It just dragged on and on and on for years, and the salary was, you know, continued for 20, 25 years at $8 and $10 an hour, just like one job after another. And you can't live on that. That's impossible. You know, I really like to do a flip on this bum word, you know, because I think that it's a great aspiration to aspire to have as much free time as possible to do, you know, whatever it is that you'd like to do during your free time. That's all I ever worked for in my whole life, was to get free time.
What do you do with it now that you have free time?
Now I socialize a lot. I've been helping a lot of people who, people with mental disabilities, you know, who, I've had a lot of success in foraging, you know, and dumpster diving and so forth. And so I've been able to get a lot of tents and sleeping bags. And so I'll set up a small encampment, and someone will come along, and I'll say, well, here, this is yours, no rent, you know, and let's see what happens. And just give them a free range. And I've actually saved a couple of lives, and I've met a lot of really very interesting people, you know.
It's illegal to be homeless in the United States, basically. Wheelchair Danny, who's only in the film for a short spell, he was invited to a function with Habitat for Humanity, and they had all these posters up of shanty towns all over the world, and then posters of the housing that they built. And Danny was standing there looking around, and he's like, well, you know, where's the shanty town from the United States? Oh, you can't do that. Homeless people would love to be able to live in a cardboard shack, only to know that it's not going to be torn down when they're away. Only to know that they have a place that they can go to every night. The thing that was fantastic about the landfill, it was pretty much sanctioned by the police for 10 years. If Albany cops caught you in a doorway in Albany, they would say, you know, go to Berkeley, go to El Cerrito, get out of our town, or you can go to the landfill, we won't bother you. People were going out there, establishing little houses. They had, you know, their own protocol there, for the most part, respected each other's property. But the thing is, because they had a place to go to at the end of the day, after recycling all day, or panhandling, or dumpster diving, whatever it was, they had a chance to unwind and think and relax. And that's where I think a lot of the creative expression came from in the landfill. People had a chance to sit down and write and think about and write their thoughts, paint on rocks, whatever. And you just can't do that if you're homeless on the streets, looking for a different doorway every night, and getting kicked out and, you know, dragged out and your possessions thrown away. It's really a shame what's going on. It's like illegal to be homeless. I mean, you just can't win.
Thomas McCabe and Robert Berenger, filmmaker and the subject and collaborator of Bum's Paradise. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Hello, you're listening to Hole in the Bucket. That was an interview by Peter Crimmins of KALX Radio in Berkeley, California. He was speaking with Thomas McCabe, maker of the new documentary film Bum's Paradise, and Robert Berenger, one of the film's chief subjects. Bum's Paradise will be showing at Clinton Street Theater on March 27th, and that'll be at 7 p.m. It'll also be showing at Reed College on March 28th at 2 p.m., and later that evening at Dignity Village at 6 p.m. And it'll also be showing on Tuesday the 30th at Reed College at 7 p.m. So go check it out, and you can also check out their website. It's www.bumsparadise.com. And next, an announcement we have. Affordable Housing Now is holding a rally in support of funding for affordable housing tomorrow. That is Thursday, March 11th from noon to 1 p.m. The rally is at Portland City Hall, which is located at 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue, just off the 14 bus line. Affordable Housing Now needs support to show our elected leaders that affordable housing is a community priority. Stable, affordable housing remains out of reach for far too many Portlanders. AHN is asking the Portland City Council to renew its commitment to the Housing Investment Fund with an allocation of $30 million. This investment is needed to maintain existing programs and new housing opportunities for families in our community. If you are available at noon tomorrow, your friends here at Hole in the Bucket highly urge you to be at City Hall. That's at noon tomorrow at City Hall. And that's located at 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue. Give your support to affordable housing. I'm also told that there will be punch and pie available at the event. Don't quote me on that, though. So that concludes today's show. Hole in the Bucket is on 6 to 7 p.m., the second and fifth Wednesday of every month. We'll be on later this month on Wednesday the 31st. If you have any comments or ideas, you can send them to kboobucket@yahoo.com or mail us at Hole in the Bucket, KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I'd like to thank our engineer, Liam Delta, and Jay Feemeyer, and our guest, Charles Santos from Roots, and Angel Williamson from White Allies Against Racism, a project of Roots. Coming up, listen to the KBOO community calendar. Next week, we will be at this time, you'll be listening to Circle A Radio, KBOO's Anarchist Feminist Collective. Following the show will be Nonstop Hip Hop with DJ Audio here at KBOO Portland.